And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure here again. We've just had our health chat, and now we're through to the book reading. And we've been reading Nicholas Nickleby, and a very, very interesting book by Charles Dickens, with a certain degree of humour in it, and a great deal of understanding of his fellow man, I might say, and women, for that matter. And before we go any further with that, a word from the people who make our station possible.
Braidwood Community Bank, your local community bank supporting your local community. For friendly, helpful advice on general banking, investments, home loans, personal loans, retirement and superannuation and insurance, contact Braidwood Community Bank on 4842 1700.
And they're open 9:30 to 4:30 on weekdays. The branch will now be closed on Saturdays.
A proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Long-term Braidwood FM sponsor, Hockey's Braidwood, have a tilt tray that has a capability to carry 20-foot shipping containers and anything around 12.5 tonne. Hockey's can also supply you with bulk water deliveries, gravel, and they have a Kanga Mini for hire. You can phone the office on 4842 2286 or Stephen Hockey on 0429 422 286.
Holdfast Distillery is Braidwood's first distillery, located in the basement of Braidwood Hotel at 180 Wallace Street. Their products are made with Australian grain and are distilled in their specially designed still to produce clean and crisp products. They select the best botanicals grown in Australia or sourced from overseas, ensuring there is no compromise in their products. Call 0406 083 963 for opening hours. Holdfast Distillery, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a very big thank you to our sponsors. And of course, we've been reading Nicholas Nickleby, and we have been looking into the United Metropolitan Improved Hot Muffin and Crumpet Baking and Punctual Delivery Company. Sound a bit sus? Well, dear listener, I can tell you, you have not heard anything yet. The meeting is underway. Mr. Bonney then presented himself to move the first resolution, and having run his right hand through his hair and planted his left in an easy manner in his ribs, he consigned his hat to the care of the gentleman with the double chin, who acted as a species of bottle holder to the orators generally, and said he would read to them the first resolution. That this meeting views with alarm and apprehension the existing state of the muffin trade in this metropolis and its neighbourhood, that it considers the muffin boys as at present constituted wholly undeserving the confidence of the public, and that it deems the whole muffin system alike prejudicial to the health and morals of the people, and subversive of the best interests of a great commercial and mercantile community. The honourable gentleman made a speech which drew tears from the eyes of the ladies, and awakened the liveliest emotions in every individual present. He had visited the houses of the poor in the various districts of London, and had found them destitute of the slightest vestige of a muffin, which there appeared too much reason to believe some of these indigent persons did not taste from year to year's end. He had found that among muffin sellers there existed drunkenness, debauchery, and profligacy, which he attributed to the debasing nature of their employment as at present exercised. He had found the same vices among the poorer class of people who ought to be muffin consumers, and this he attributed to the despair engendered by their being placed beyond the reach of that nutritious article which drove them to seek a false stimulant in intoxicating liquors. He would undertake to prove before a committee of the House of Commons that there existed a combination to keep up the price of muffins and to give the bellmen a monopoly. He would prove it by bellmen at the bar of that house. He would also prove that these men corresponded with each other by secret words and signs, as Snooks, Walker, Ferguson, Is Murphy Right, and many others. It was this melancholy state of things that the company proposed to correct, firstly by prohibiting, under heavy penalties, all private muffin trading of every description. Secondly, by themselves supplying the public generally, and the poor at their own homes, with muffins of first quality at reduced prices. It was with this object that a bill had been introduced into Parliament by their patriotic chairman, Sir Matthew Pupker. It was this bill that they had meant to support. It was the supporters of this bill who would confer undying brightness and splendour upon England under the name of the United Metropolitan Improved Hot Muffin and Crumpet Baking and Punctual Delivery Company. He would add, with a capital of 5 millions and 500,000 shares of £10 each. Mr. Ralph Nickleby seconded the resolution, and another gentleman, having moved that it be amended by the insertion of the words "and crumpet" after the word "muffin" whenever it occurred, it was carried triumphantly. Only one man in the crowd cried "No!" and he was promptly taken into custody and straightaway borne off. The second resolution, which recognised the expediency of immediately abolishing all muffin or crumpet sellers, all traders in muffins or crumpets, of whatsoever description, whether male or female, boys or men, ringing handbells or otherwise, was moved by a grievous gentleman of semi-clerical appearance, who went at once into such deep pathetics that he knocked the first speaker clean out of the course in no time. You might have heard a pin fall, a pin, a feather, as he described the cruelties inflicted on muffin boys by their masters, which he very wisely urged were in themselves a sufficient reason for the establishment of that inestimable company. It seemed that the unhappy youths were nightly turned out into the wet streets at the most inclement periods of the year to wander about in darkness and rain, or it might be hail or snow, for hours together without shelter, food, or warmth. And let the public never forget upon the latter point that while the muffins were provided with warm clothing and blankets, the boys were wholly unprovided for and left to their own miserable resources. Shame! The honourable gentleman related one case of a muffin boy who, having been exposed to this inhuman and barbarous system for no less than 5 years, at length fell a victim to a cold in the head, beneath which he gradually sunk until he fell into a perspiration and recovered. This he could vouch for on his own authority, but he had heard, and he had no reason to doubt the fact, of a still more heart-rending and appalling circumstance. He had heard of the case of an orphan muffin boy who, having been run over by a hackney carriage, had been removed to the hospital, had undergone the amputation of his leg below the knee, and was now actually pursuing his occupation on crutches. Fountain of justice were these things to last. This was the department of the subject that took the meeting, and this was the style of speaking to enlist their sympathies. The men shouted, the ladies wept into their pocket handkerchiefs till they were moist and waved them until they were dry. The excitement was tremendous, and Mr. Nickleby whispered his friend that the shares were thenceforth at a premium of 5 and 20%. The resolution was, of course, carried with loud acclamations, every man holding up both hands in favour of it, as he would, in his enthusiasm, have held up both legs also, if he could have conveniently accomplished it. This done, the draft of the proposed petition was read at length, and the petition said, as all petitions do say, that the petitioners were very humble, and the petitioned very honourable, and the object very virtuous. There, said the petition, the bill ought to be passed into law at once, to the everlasting honour and glory of that most honourable and glorious Commons of England in Parliament assembled. Then the gentlemen, who had been at Crockford's all night and who looked something the worse about the eyes in consequence, came forward to tell his fellow countrymen that a speech he meant to make in favour of that petition, whenever it should be presented, and how desperately he meant to taunt the Parliament if they rejected the bill, and to inform them also that he regretted his honourable friends had not inserted a clause rendering the purchase of muffins and crumpets compulsory upon all classes of the community, which he, opposing all half measures and preferring to go the extreme animal, pledged himself to propose and divide upon in committee. After announcing this determination, the honourable gentleman grew jocular, and as patent boots, lemon-coloured kid gloves and a fur coat collar assist jokes materially, there was immense laughter and much cheering, and moreover, such a brilliant display of ladies' pocket handkerchiefs as threw this grievous gentleman quite into the shade. And when the petition had been read and was about to be adopted, there came forward the Irish member, who was a young gentleman of ardent temperament, with such a speech as only an Irish member can make, breathing the true soul and spirit of poetry, and poured forth with such fervour that it made one warm to look at him. In the course whereof, he told them how he would demand the extension of that great boon to his native country, how he would claim for her equal rights in the muffin laws as in all other laws, and how he yet hoped to see the day when crumpets should be toasted in her lowly cabins and muffin bells should ring in her rich green valleys. And after him came the Scotch member, with various pleasant allusions to the probable amount of profits which increased the good humour that the poetry had awakened. And all the speeches put together did exactly what they were intended to do, and established in the hearers' minds that there was no speculation so promising, or at the same time so praiseworthy, as the United Metropolitan Improved Hot Muffin and Crumpet Baking and Punctual Delivery Company. So the petition in favour of the bill was agreed upon, and the meeting adjourned with acclamations, and Mr. Nickleby and the other directors went to the office to lunch, as they did every day at 1:30, and to remunerate themselves, for which trouble, as the company was yet in its infancy, they only charged 3 guineas each man for every such attendance. Chapter 3. Mr. Ralph Nickleby receives sad tidings of his brother, but bears up nobly against the intelligence communicated to him. The reader is informed how he liked Nicholas, who is herein introduced, and how kindly he proposed to make his fortune at once. Having rendered his zealous assistance towards the dispatching of lunch with all that promptitude and energy which are among the most important qualities that men of business can possess, Mr. Ralph Nickleby took a cordial farewell of his fellow speculators and bent his steps westward in unwonted good humour. As he passed St. Paul's, he stepped aside into a doorway and set his watch, and with his hand on the key and his eye on the cathedral dial, was intent upon so doing when a man suddenly stopped before him. It was Newman Noggs. "Nah, Newman," said Mr. Nickleby, looking up as he pursued his occupation. "The letter about the mortgage has come, has it? I thought it would."
"Wrong," replied Newman.
"What? And nobody called respecting it?" inquired Mr. Nickleby, pausing. Noggs shook his head. "Well, what has come then?" inquired Mr. Nickleby.
"I have," said Newman.
"What else?" demanded the master sternly.
This, said Newman, drawing a sealed letter slowly from his pocket. "Postmark, Strand, black wax, black border, woman's hand, seeing in the corner."
"Black wax," said Mr. Nickleby, glancing at the letter. "I know something of that hand, too. Newman, I shouldn't be surprised if my brother were dead."
"Oh, I don't think you would," said Newman quietly.
"Why not, sir?" demanded Mr. Nickleby.
You're never surprised," replied Newman. "That's all."
Mr. Nickleby snatched the letter from his assistant, and fixing a cold look upon him, opened, read it, put it in his pocket, and having now hit the time to a second, began winding up his watch. "It is as I expected, Newman," said Mr. Nickleby while he was thus engaged. "He is dead."
"Dear me, well, that's a sudden thing. I shouldn't have thought. It really...
With these touching expressions of sorrow, Mr. Nickleby replaced his watch and his fob, and fitting on his gloves to a nicety, turned upon his way and walked slowly westward with his hands behind him.
Children alive? Inquired Noggs, stepping up to him.
Why, that's the very thing, replied Mr. Nickleby, as though his thoughts were about them at that moment. They are both alive.
Both, repeated Newman Noggs in a low voice.
And the widow, too, added Mr. Nickleby. And all three in London, confound them. All three. Here, Newman.
Newman fell a little behind his master, and his face was curiously twisted, as by a spasm. But whether of paralysis or grief or inward laughter, nobody but himself could possibly explain. The expression of a man's face is commonly a help to his thoughts, or glossary on his speech. But the countenance of Newman Noggs, in his ordinary moods, was a problem which no stretch of ingenuity could solve.
"Go home," said Mr. Nickleby, after they had walked a few paces, looking around at the clerk as if he were his dog. The words were scarcely uttered when Newman darted across the road, slunk among the crowd, and disappeared in an instant.
"Reasonable, certainly," muttered Mr. Nickleby to himself as he walked on. "Very reasonable. My brother never did anything for me, and I never expected it. The breath is no sooner out of his body than I'm to be looked to as the supporter of a great hearty woman and a grown boy and girl. What are they to me? I never saw them."
Full of these and many other reflections of a similar kind, Mr. Nickleby made the best of his way to the Strand, and, referring to his letter as if to ascertain the number of the house he wanted, stopped at a private door about halfway down that crowded thoroughfare. A miniature painter lived there, for there was a large gilt frame screwed upon the street door, in which were displayed upon a black velvet ground two portraits of naval dress coats with faces looking out of them and telescopes attached, one of a young gentleman in a very vermilion uniform flourishing his sabre, and one of a literary character with a high forehead, a pen and ink, six books and a curtain. There was, moreover, a touching representation of a young lady reading a manuscript in an unfathomable forest, and a charming whole length of a large-headed little boy sitting on a stool with his legs foreshortened to the size of salt spoons. Besides these works of art, there were a great many heads of old ladies and gentlemen smirking at each other out of blue and brown skies, and an elegantly written card of terms with an embossed border. Mr. Nickleby glanced at these frivolities with great contempt, and gave a double knock, which, having been thrice repeated, was answered by a servant girl with an uncommonly dirty face.
"Is Mrs. Nickleby at home, girl?" demanded Ralph sharply.
"Her name ain't Nickleby," said the girl. "La Creevy, you mean?"
Mr. Nickleby looked very indignant at the handmaid on this being thus corrected, and demanded with much asperity what she meant, which she was about to state, when a female voice, proceeded from a perpendicular staircase at the end of the passage, inquired what was wanted.
"Mrs. Nickleby," said Ralph.
"It's the second floor, Hannah," said the same voice. "What a stupid thing you are. It's the second floor. At home?"
Somebody went out just now, but I think it was the attic which had been a cleaning of himself," replied the girl.
"You had better see," said the invisible female. "Show the gentleman where the bell is and tell him he mustn't knock double knocks for the second floor. I can't allow a knock except when the bell's broke, and then it must be two single ones."
"Here," said Ralph, walking in without more parley. "I beg your pardon, is that Mrs. what was her name?"
"Creevy, La Creevy,"
replied the voice, as a yellow headdress bobbed over the banisters.
"I'll speak to you in a moment, ma'am, with your leave."
The voice replied that the gentleman was to walk up, but he had walked up before it spoke, and stepping into the first floor was received by the wearer of the yellow headdress, who had a gown to correspond, and was much the same colour herself. Miss La Creevy was a mincing young lady of 50, and Miss La Creevy's apartment was the gilt frame downstairs on a larger scale, and something dirtier.
Said Miss La Creevy, coughing delicately behind a black silk mitten. "A miniature, I presume?"
"A very strongly marked countenance for the purpose, sir. Have you ever sat before?"
"You mistake my purpose, I see, ma'am," replied Mr. Nickleby in his usual blunt fashion. "I have no money to throw away on miniatures, ma'am, and nobody to give one to, thank God, if I had. Seeing you on the stairs, I wanted to ask a question of you about some lodgers here." Miss La Creevy coughed once more. This cough was to conceal her disappointment, and said, "Oh, indeed. I infer, from what you said to your servant, that the floor above belongs to you, ma'am," said Mr. Nickleby. "Yes, it did," Miss La Creevy replied. "The upper part of the house belonged to her, and, as she had no necessity for the second floor rooms just then, she was in the habit of letting them. Indeed, there was a lady from the country and her two children in them at the present speaking." "A widow, ma'am?" said Ralph. "Yes, she is a widow," replied the lady. "A poor widow, ma'am," said Ralph, with a powerful emphasis on that little adjective which conveys so much. "Well, I am afraid she is poor," rejoined Miss La Creevy. "I happen to know that she is, ma'am," said Ralph. "Now, what business has a poor widow in such a house as this, ma'am?" "Very true," replied Miss La Creevy, not at all displeased with this implied compliment to the apartments. "Exceedingly true. I know her circumstances intimately, ma'am," said Ralph. "In fact, I am a relation of the family, and I should recommend you not to keep them here, ma'am."
"Well, I should hope, if there was any incompatibility, to meet the pecuniary obligations," said Miss La Creevy with another cough, "that the lady's family would..."
"No, they wouldn't, ma'am," interrupted Ralph hastily. "Don't think it."
If I am to understand that," said Miss La Creevy, "the case wears a very different appearance."
"You may understand it then, ma'am," said Ralph, "and make your arrangements accordingly. I am the family, ma'am, at least I believe I am the only relation they have, and I think it right that you should know I can't support them in their extravagances. How long have they taken these lodgings for?"
"Only from week to week," replied Miss La Creevy. "Mrs. Nickleby paid the first week in advance."
"Then you had better get them out at the end of it," said Ralph. "They can't do better than go back to the country, ma'am. They are in everybody's way here."
"Certainly," said Miss La Creevy, rubbing her hands. "If Mrs. Nickleby took the apartments without the means of paying for them, it was very unbecoming of a lady."
"Of course it was, ma'am," said Ralph.
"And naturally," continued Miss La Creevy, "I who am at present an unprotected female cannot afford to lose by the apartments."
"Of course you can't, ma'am," replied Ralph.
"Though at the same time," added Miss La Creevy, who was plainly wavering between her good nature and her interest, "I have nothing whatever to say against the lady, who is extremely pleasant and affable, though, poor thing, she seems terribly low in spirits, nor against the young people either, for nicer or better behaved young people cannot be."
"Very well, ma'am," said Ralph, turning to the door, for these encomiums on poverty irritated him. "I have done my duty, and perhaps more than I ought. Of course, nobody will thank me for saying what I have."
"I am sure I am very much obliged to you, at least, sir," said Miss La Creevy in a gracious manner. "Would you do me the favour to look at a few specimens of my portrait painting?"
"You're very good, ma'am," said Mr. Nickleby, making off with great speed. "But as I have to pay a visit upstairs, and my time is precious, I really can't."
"At any other time when you are passing, I shall be most happy," said Miss La Creevy. "Perhaps you will have the kindness to take a card of terms with you. Thank you. Good morning."
"Good morning, ma'am," said Ralph, shutting the door abruptly after him to prevent any further conversation. "Now for my sister-in-law." Pah!
Climbing up another perpendicular flight, composed with great mechanical ingenuity of nothing but corner stairs, Mr. Ralph Nickleby stepped to take breath on the landing, when he was overtaken by the handmaid, whom the politeness of Miss La Creevy had dispatched to announce him, and who had apparently been making a variety of unsuccessful attempts since their last interview to wipe her dirty face clean upon an apron that was much dirtier.
"What name?" said the girl.
"Nickleby," replied Ralph.
"Oh, Mrs. Nickleby," said the girl,
throwing open the door. "Here's Mr. Nickleby."
A lady in deep mourning rose as Mr. Ralph Nickleby entered, but appeared incapable of advancing to meet him, and leant upon the arm of a slight but very beautiful girl of about 17, who had been sitting by her. A youth who appeared a year or two older stepped forward and saluted Ralph as his uncle.
"Oh," growled Ralph with an ill-favoured frown, "you are Nicholas, I suppose."
"That is my name, sir," replied the youth.
"Put my hat down," said Ralph imperiously.
"Well, ma'am, how do you do? You must bear up against sorrow, ma'am. I always do." "Mine was no common loss," said Mrs. Nickleby, applying her handkerchief to her eyes.
It was no uncommon loss, ma'am," returned Ralph, as he coolly unbuttoned his spencer. "Husbands die every day, ma'am, and wives too."
"And brothers also, sir," said Nicholas with a glance of indignation.
"Yes, sir, and puppies and pug dogs likewise," replied his uncle, taking a chair. "You didn't mention in your letter what my brother's complaint was, ma'am."
The doctors could attribute it to no particular disease," said Mrs. Nickleby, shedding tears.
We have too much reason to fear that he died of a broken heart." "Pah," said Ralph. "There's no such thing. I can understand a man's dying of a broken neck, or suffering from a broken arm, or a broken head, or a broken leg, or a broken nose, but a broken heart? Nonsense. It's the cant of the day. A man can't pay his debts. He dies of a broken heart, and his widow's a martyr."
"Some people, I believe, have no hearts to break," observed Nicholas quietly.
"How old is this boy, for God's sake?" inquired Ralph, wheeling back his chair and surveying his nephew from head to foot with intense scorn.
Nicholas is very nearly 19, replied the widow.
19, eh? Said Ralph. "And what do you mean to do for your bread, sir?"
"Not to live upon my mother," replied Nicholas, his head swelling, his heart swelling as he spoke.
"You'd have little enough to live upon if you did," retorted the uncle, eyeing him contemptuously.
"Whatever it be," said Nicholas, flushed with anger, "I shall not look to you to make it more."
"Nicholas, my dear, recollect yourself," remonstrated Mrs. Nickleby.
"Dear Nicholas, pray," urged the young lady.
"Hold your tongue, sir," said Ralph. "Upon my word, fine beginnings, Mrs. Nickleby, fine beginnings."
Mrs. Nickleby made no other reply than entreating Nicholas by a gesture to keep silent, and the uncle and nephew looked at each other for some seconds without speaking. The face of the old man was stern, hard-featured, and forbidding, that of the young one open, handsome, and ingenuous. The old man's eye was keen with the twinklings of avarice and cunning, the young man's bright with the light of intelligence and spirit. His figure was somewhat slight but manly and well-formed, and apart from all the grace of youth and comeliness, there was an emanation from the warm young heart in his look and bearing which kept the old man down. However, striking such a contrast as this may be to lookers-on, none ever feel it with half the keenness or acuteness of perfection with which it strikes to the very soul of him whose inferiority it marks. It galled Ralph to the heart's core, and he hated Nicholas from that hour. The mutual inspection was at length brought to a close by Ralph withdrawing his eyes with a great show of disdain and calling Nicholas a boy. This word is much used as a term of reproach by elderly gentlemen towards their juniors, probably with the view of deluding society into the belief that they could be young again. They wouldn't, though, on any account.
"Well, ma'am," said Ralph impatiently, "the creditors have administered, you tell me, and there's nothing left for you?"
"Nothing," replied Mrs. Nickleby.
"And you spent what little money you had in coming all the way to London to see what I could do for you?" pursued Ralph.
"I hoped," faltered Mrs. Nickleby, "that you might have an opportunity of doing something for your brother's children. It was his dying wish that I should appeal to you in their behalf."
"I don't know how it is," muttered Ralph, walking up and down the room. But whenever a man dies without property of his own, he always seems to think he has a right to dispose of other people's. What is your daughter fit for, Mum?
Kate has been well educated, sobbed Mrs. Nickleby. Tell your uncle, my dear, how far you went in French and extras.
The poor girl was about to murmur something when her uncle stopped her very unceremoniously.
We must try and get you apprenticed at some boarding school, said Ralph. You have not been brought up too delicately for that, I hope.
No, indeed, uncle, replied the weeping girl. I'll try to do anything that will gain me a home and bread.
Well, well, said Ralph, a little softened, either by his niece's beauty or her distress. Well, stretch a point and say the latter.
You must try it, and if the life is too hard, perhaps dressmaking or tambour work will come lighter. Have you ever done anything, sir?
Turning to his nephew.
No, replied Nicholas, bluntly.
No, I thought not, said Ralph. This is the way my brother brought up his children, ma'am.
Nicholas has not long completed such education as his poor father could give him, rejoined Mrs. Nickleby, and he was thinking of
making something of him some day, said Ralph.
The old story, always thinking, never doing.
If my brother had been a man of activity and prudence, he might have left you a rich woman, ma'am.
And if he had turned his son into the world as my father turned me, when I wasn't as old as that boy by a year and a half, he would have been in a situation to help you, instead of being a burden upon you and increasing your distress. My brother was a thoughtless, inconsiderate man, Mrs. Nickleby, and nobody, I am sure, can have better reason to feel that than you.
This appeal set the widow upon thinking that perhaps she might have made a more successful venture with her £1,000, and then she began to reflect what a comfortable sum it would have been just then. Which dismal thoughts made her tears flow faster, and, in the excess of these griefs, she, being a well-meaning woman enough but weak withal, fell first to deploring her hard fate, and then to remarking with many sobs that to be sure she had been a slave to poor Nicholas, and had often told him she might have married better, as indeed she had very often, and that she never knew in his lifetime how the money went, but that if he had confided in her, they might have all have been better off that day, with bitter recollections common to most married ladies, either during their coverture or afterwards, or at both periods. Mrs. Nickleby concluded by lamenting that the dear departed had never deigned to profit by her advice, save on one occasion, which was a strictly veracious statement, inasmuch as he had only acted upon it once, and had ruined himself in consequence. Mr. Ralph Nickleby heard all this with a half smile, and when the widow had finished, quietly took up the subject where it had been left before the above outbreak.
"Are you willing to work, sir?" he inquired, frowning at his nephew.
"Of course I am," replied Nicholas haughtily.
"Then see here, sir," said his uncle. "This caught my eye this morning, and you may thank your stars for it."
With this exordium, Mr. Ralph Nickleby took out a newspaper from his pocket, and, after unfolding it and looking for a short time among the advertisements, read as follows.
"Education. At Mr. Wackford Squeers Academy, Dotheboys Hall, at the delightful village of Dotheboys near Greta Bridge in Yorkshire. Youth are boarded, clothed, booked, furnished, with pocket money, provided with all necessaries, instructed in all languages, living and dead, mathematics, orthography, geometry, astronomy, trigonometry, the use of the globe, algebra, single stick if required, writing, arithmetic, fortification, and every other branch of classical literature. Terms, 20 guineas per annum. No extras, no vacations, and diet unparalleled. Mr. Squeers is in town and attends daily from 1 till 4 at the Saracen's Head, Snow Hill. N.B. An able assistant wanted, annual salary, £5. A Master of Arts would be preferred."
"There," said Ralph, folding the paper again. "Let him get that situation and his fortune is made."
"But he is not a Master of Arts," said Mrs. Nickleby.
"Ah, that," replied Ralph, "that, I think, can be got over. But
"The salary is so small, and it's such a long way off, Uncle," faltered Kate.
"Hush, Kate, my dear," interposed Mrs. Nickleby. "Your uncle must know best."
"I say," repeated Ralph tartly, "let him get that situation and his fortune is made. If he don't like that, let him get one for himself. Without friends, honest employment in London, which will keep him in shoe leather, and I'll give him £1,000. At least," said Mr. Ralph Nickleby, checking himself, "I would if I had it."
"Poor fellow," said the young lady. "Oh, Uncle, must we be separated so soon?" "Don't tease your uncle with questions when he is thinking only of our good, my love," said Mrs. Nickleby. "Nicholas, my dear, I wish you would say something."
"Yes, mother, yes," said Nicholas, who had hitherto remained silent and absorbed in thought. "If I am fortunate enough to be appointed to this post, sir, for which I am so imperfectly qualified, what would become of those I leave behind?"
"Your mother and sister, sir," replied Ralph, "will be provided for, in that case, not otherwise, by me, and placed in some sphere of life in which they will be able to be independent. That will be my immediate care. They will not remain as they are 1 week after your departure, I will undertake."
"Then," said Nicholas, starting gaily up and wringing his uncle's hand, "I'm ready to do anything you wish me. Let us try our fortune with Mr. Squeers at once. He can't but refuse."
"Oh, he won't do that," said Ralph. "He will be glad to have you on my recommendation. Make yourself of use to him, and you'll rise to be a partner in the establishment in no time. Bless me, only to think, if he were to die, why, your fortune's made at once."
"To be sure, sir, I see it all," said poor Nicholas, delighted with 1,000 visionary ideas that his good spirits and his inexperience were conjuring up before him. "Or suppose some young nobleman who is being educated at the Hall were to take a fancy to me and get his father to appoint me his travelling tutor when he left, and when we come back from the Continent procured me some handsome appointment, eh, Uncle?"
"Ah, to be sure," sneered Ralph.
"And who knows, but when he came to see me, when I was settled, as he would, of course, he might fall in love with Kate, who would be keeping my house and marry her, eh, Uncle? Who knows?"
"Who indeed?" snarled Ralph.
"How happy we would be," cried Nicholas with enthusiasm. "The pain of parting is nothing to the joy of meeting again. Kate will be a beautiful woman, and I'm so proud to hear them say so, and Mother so happy to be with us once again, and all these sad times forgotten, and—" The picture was too bright a one to bear, and Nicholas, fairly overpowered by it, smiled faintly and burst into tears. This simple family, born and bred in retirement, and wholly unacquainted with what is called the world, a conventional phrase which, being interpreted often, signifieth all the rascals in it, mingled their tears together at the thought of their first separation, and this first gush of feeling over were proceeding to dilate with all the buoyancy of untried hope on the bright prospects before them, when Mr. Ralph Nickleby suggested that if they lost no time, some more fortunate candidate might deprive Nicholas of the stepping stone to fortune which the advertisement pointed out, and so undermine all their air-built castles. This timely reminder effectively stopped the conversation. Nicholas, having carefully copied the address of Mr. Squeers, the uncle and nephew issued forth together in quest of that accomplished gentleman, Nicholas firmly persuading himself that he had done his relative great injustice in disliking him at first sight, and Mr. Nickleby being at some pains to inform her daughter that she was sure he was a much more kindly disposed person than he seemed, which Miss Nickleby dutifully remarked he might very easily be. To tell the truth, the good lady's opinion had not a little been a little influenced by her brother-in-law's appeal to her better understanding and his implied compliment to her high deserts, and although she had dearly loved her husband and still doted on her children, he had struck so successfully on one of those little jarring chords in the human heart — Ralph was well acquainted with its worst weaknesses, though he knew nothing of its best — that she had already begun seriously to consider herself the amiable and suffering victim of her late husband's imprudence. And that is Nicholas Nickleby for today. I'll be back next Monday with the next instalment. Until then, keep well and stay safe.